This is The Think Tank, talking about the major political, economic, and social issues of the week. With Dr. Mike O'Neill and hosted by Mike Russell. KTAR News on 92.3 FM and KTAR.com. The Think Tank.
So kind of a version of how I spent my summer vacation. Doc O'Neill's been on vacation in, you know, when I think of places to go, places you might want to visit, places you want to spend your summer vacation, Vietnam is on the 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, 16, 17, 18, 19, 20, 21, 22, 23, 24, 25, 26, 27, 28, 29, 30. Is about 47th, I think I have that here on my list. But you actually went to Vietnam for how long were you gone?
I was gone for 3 weeks.
Wow, okay.
And it was an absolutely incredible experience. And yeah, I mean, I'm a little older than you are, okay. So I lived through this.
Sure.
I mean,
the war you're talking about.
What they call the U.S. war, because they had multiple. In Vietnam, U.S. involvement.
Wait, stop. No pain over that. So Vietnam goes, they've had so many wars. They just call it the U.S. war.
They don't call it the Vietnam War.
Okay. Well, I mean, they call it the U.S. war.
They call it the U.S. war. Prior to that, they had the French War.
Okay.
Which was basically from 46 to 54.
Man.
And I'll talk later through the whole history of that.
All right.
But,
we'll get there.
But basically, first they fought the French, then they fought us.
Okay.
So obviously they're not going to call it the Vietnam War because they are Vietnam.
Dang.
But anyway, the U.S.
has a better ring
sponsorship of or direct participation in the war in Vietnam started before I was born, and by the time our involvement ended, I was in pretty advanced in through graduate school.
So it just hung.
I mean, I remember talking about this issue in grade school. All the way through high school, college, the whole thing.
Nauseam.
It was just this big, it was this thing that was going to never end. So anyway, what did I do?
Yeah.
I went to Hanoi, which is a fascinating town and frankly, much more interesting than Saigon. Saigon is 10 million people, very, very modern. And it's like you're in there and it could be like any big city almost anywhere,
okay.
with some aspects that are kind of developing country, but still, Halong Bay was the vacation within a vacation. You've seen these iconic photos of these mountains coming out of the water.
Oh yeah,
yeah. I mean, that is this incredible place. You go out there and the incomparable scenery, and then taking kayaks out to the edges of some of these mountains.
Some of the
kayaks out, and there's on these little mountains, there's colonies of monkeys. It's very, very cool.
Okay, well, don't brush over that. You took kayaks out. That's kind of cool.
Yeah.
I don't see you as the kayak guy.
Well,
I'm a kayak fishing guy. This is the way to go.
For a few hours. This was the respite within a kind of education.
Right.
Went to Hue, which was figured very large in 1968. It was the first city to be basically taken over by the North in the offensive. It was kind of the offensive that changed the psychology of the war. So went there. Hoi An, which is a cool little town that basically where I bought tons and tons of art.
Really?
For you know, pennies.
Yeah, basically. Taking advantage of the cheap labor. I see how you are, Doc.
Ho Chi Minh City, Saigon, Mekong Delta, where I hooked up with a homestay with a former ARVN, that's Army of Vietnam, South Vietnamese Army officer, trained in the U.S., who went back. Who basically, you know, stayed there, did a couple years in prison.
Did you know this person? How do you hook that kind of thing?
Friend of a friend of a friend.
Okay.
Just through pure accident, and it was fascinating. I mean, I could talk about this guy. You know, after 75, we left. He's on the losing side. 2 years in jail. Basically, there was a whole lot of repercussions. And he basically said how long you spent in jail was a function of how high you were in the military hierarchy.
Wow.
He was a first lieutenant. He got 2 years.
Okay. So the higher you were, the lower amount of prison.
No, the more.
Really?
The generals got 25 years.
Jeez.
Okay.
Okay.
They were held responsible. The privates pretty much got a pass.
Yeah.
So Hoa La prison, which was famously where McCain was. Interesting story on that.
Mm-hmm.
Realized it had this whole prior history. It was built by the French to imprison Vietnamese who were basically fighting for independence for Vietnam.
Okay.
And frankly, going through the exhibits there, as badly as McCain was treated there, it didn't hold a candle to what the French did to the Vietnamese.
Okay.
I mean, just the shackles and stuff like that. The guillotine was a little figured large.
Well, the guillotine, well, obviously. I mean, that's
but that
not,
was
that's
one of the
torture,
kinder
that's,
things.
Yeah, exactly.
The guillotine
that's,
was one of the kinder
getting
things.
Getting killed.
That, I mean, if you truthfully, if you're going to, if somebody's going to go, that's, you know, the guillotine was put in as a humane instrument.
Darn right it is.
It was.
Should be brought back.
If you're going to kill somebody, it's probably about the cleanest way to do it.
Thank you.
But the treatment in there was, I mean, basically the Vietnamese who were there in the earlier years, basically they had both legs shackled to the ground and they were immobilized for long stretches of their period.
Well, McCain didn't have a walk in the park.
Oh, no.
Okay.
But I'm saying that, I mean, I've gone in and since validated this with historical references and all. No, he was, and by the way, in their presentation of it was a little fairy tale-ish too.
I can imagine.
You know, they're,
right.
In their display, they show the volleyball games and stuff like that.
What,
you know,
cages?
No, he was not treated well, but I think it's historically verified the French treated their Vietnamese prisoners actually much worse. I think, and I've talked to people about that, why, and I think it's the old colonial mentality of this is an inferior people, and therefore you can, it's kind of like slavery
very
notions,
French.
Whatever. You, if it's an inferior people, then it's okay to, you know, to be worse.
Got it.
So,
all right.
Anyway, some impressions. Hanoi, one of the real, and a traveling companion who's from China, and she made the analogy was interesting. She said, Hanoi, that's like Shanghai in 1985. Ho Chi Minh City is like Shanghai in 2000. In other words, they're a little behind the curve.
Yeah.
One of the interesting things you see, development is very you have developed countries, you have undeveloped countries. This is in between. This has got a foot in one each side. So you'll see shacks and tin roofs. And you will see in the middle of this little backwater, you know, down these dirt alleys, whatever, and you'll see one shack among many, and it's a bunch of teenagers in there playing internet games.
Oh, nice.
Wi-Fi everywhere, smartphone, self, probably more Wi-Fi than here because a lot of the people don't have it in the home. So every little coffee shop and small family restaurant, whatever, has Wi-Fi. So shacks and smartphones. And here's the one of the real interesting ones, and I can contrast this with China.
Hold on. I want to contrast your contrast with China, and I want to get to that in just a moment here. But what we're going to do, we're going to take a quick break. Doc just got back from Vietnam, and if you want to shock this guy, you know some good stuff's going on. So we are going to cover a little bit more of that when we come back right here on The Think Tank.
The Think Tank. KTAR News on 92.3 FM and KTAR.com.
Now over the break, Doc O'Neill told me that they had in Vietnam, they had a bunch of shirts that said, Good Morning, Vietnam. I'm an XL, buddy. Why is this tourist? You went to Vietnam and you didn't even bring me a lousy T-shirt. I would have loved a Good Morning, Vietnam.
No shortage of T-shirts. Now, let me tell you what it's like to cross the street in Vietnam.
Okay. All right.
Envision Camelback Road, street that wide, and about replace every car in Camelback Road with about 10 motorbikes,
okay?
And that's the volume, hundreds and hundreds of motorbikes, No street lights, they don't stop. In order to get across the street, what you have to do...
Play Frogger.
You just have to start walking, and you learn the strategy for doing this, is you have to walk assertively... And you have to walk in a consistent fashion. A sudden stop or a jolt, and you're probably going to be in trouble because they're not going to try to hit you, but they're not slowing down either. So you start walking, and what they
time it out,
they swerve around you.
Nice.
So the people who don't get hit, and you learn to do very quickly how to do this, is you just walk in a consistent fashion, and it's scary as all get out in the beginning. And they just swarm around you. Let me contrast that. So it's total anarchy. They have T-shirts which describe the traffic system there. And the T-shirts say, green light, go. Yellow light, also go. Red light, go again.
Nice.
Okay.
See?
No stopping. The interesting contrast, and I think there's probably something about national culture. In China, you got the same kind of thing. And what they have, though, is they got streetlights, and everybody obeys the street laws there. So there'll be a red light, and you get to stop. And every corner in China has a monitor. you know, who I thought was like some kind of a cop. It's more like a meter maid or something. And if you break the law by jaywalking or something, the punishment is immediate. And I'm looking, what are they going to do? They're going to arrest you, you go in a secret. No.
Yeah, yeah.
You know what the punishment is?
Oh, boy.
The finger shake. Public shaming.
Oh, public shame on you.
That finger comes out. It's not the middle finger. It's the index finger pointing at you, and everybody can see that you're a traffic scoffer.
That's funny.
But so it's like completely different. So you can cross the streets, and you just wait for the light, and you go. In Vietnam, it's complete and total anarchy. Nobody stops ever.
I like that, though. Talk about this then. Did you see any wrecks? There has to be wrecks.
They must happen. I never saw a single one. And I'm talking about streets that are completely filled with way more vehicles we have, because one car can be replaced by 10 motorcycles.
Sure.
And what their stage of it's a little different. Hanoi. In Hanoi is like almost all motorbikes. There's almost no the development. You go from physical bicycles to motorbikes to cars. Right now, they're probably 90% at motorbikes. You know, maybe 5% bicycles and 5% cars. Saigon is much more on. They're 15 years ahead. More cars, fewer motorbikes, but lots of both. There's still plenty of motorbikes.
And do they have traffic laws? They have signals and all
not,
that.
Not, not that I saw.
Jeez.
The other thing is, when you walk along the streets in Vietnam, you know where you walk? You walk on the street. You know why?
Why?
There's no room on the sidewalk.
What's
it's
on the sidewalk?
Hundreds and hundreds of parked motorbikes.
Oh, that's funny. Okay.
The streets are filled with little shops that are selling lunch and dinner. They're cooking dinner out there. And motorbikes. Completely. There's like no place to walk on the sidewalk. You might walk for 4 feet and then you jot out to the street. Which is, of course, you are walking amongst you don't get in the lane
bikes.
There. You are walking amongst speeding bikes.
And so did you get hit? Somebody had to have gotten hit.
This makes zero sense to
me.
It must happen, but I never saw it.
Like when you exit the plane or the airport, do they say, here's how to walk across the street?
No lessons.
Mike,
you learn real quick.
I bet. Good night.
And there were some near misses, and they were all my fault when I would start to go and I would, you know, get chicken halfway
across and
I'd stop walking. And then I realized, no, what you have to do, they're watching you, they're trying to avoid you, but what you have to do is walk in a consistent fashion.
Jeez.
Anyway, that's anecdotes. Cool. Another one. Da Nang. Anybody old enough will remember this massive U.S. airbase. And I assumed that Da Nang is a big city and they've got a big international terminal. I assumed they just took over the airbase. It turns out they didn't. So we're going along this street, maybe 50 yards from what is, by the way, some of the most extensive and beautiful beaches you've ever seen in your life. And we're going down in this tour bus. It's on your right, by the way, the former U.S. airbase. It's basically mothballs.
You know, is it really?
Huge. It's just not
they
used.
Didn't use it at all.
No. They might have used it for a while. They're not using it now. They got a big new modern terminal. They're not using it. That's on the right side of the bus. And you turn your attention to the left, and you know what you see? Giant Chinese casino.
Nice.
Followed
there you go.
A few hundred
now
yards down the road by the Hyatt and whole lots of big corporations that are setting up timeshare operations because the beaches are gorgeous.
Yeah, they do a lot of fishing there, too. They do.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's a big, big fishing country. I guess some of the conflicts with China over that.
They'll get over
it. Anyway, timeshares, all this kind of stuff. Almost no sign that they fought a war there. It's incredible. I mean, I was expecting to
see. Like Germany, too. What are you talking about?
In Germany, the East lagged. I was in Germany when I saw post-World War II stuff in the early 70s when I crossed over into the East.
Right, right.
They were still cobblestones. Attitudes towards, I expected, I wondered if there'd be negativity. None.
Okay.
In fact, they've really, even more than us, way moved past the war.
How about from the older generation, though? Maybe like the younger, I could assume that, and I could see that. But the older, I would think there's a lot of gnashing of teeth.
You know, I'm not saying that it isn't there. I'm saying I never felt it.
Okay.
I had people come up to me and shake my hands randomly and things like that.
Huh.
I think they've, for the most, I'm not saying there aren't people. And I will tell you, the only reference at all, the tour guide who's a guy about your age, born post-war, at one, he made the only reference he made in any way relate, other than pointing out where the air base was, because he knew I'd be interested. I was in an international. We had there were six Brits, four Germans, two of whom live in Norway, and two Americans. Was the tour group, was an interesting group. But he picked up on the fact that I was, so we'd point out stuff like that. And the only reference I got was an indirect one, and he was talking about we were going to the one of the war museums, and there was a display there on Agent Orange victims, and it was really incredibly gruesome stuff. I mean, deformed babies and stuff would just tear out your heartstrings.
Right.
And the only reference, and this was not made in anger, it was almost like a wistful. He said, you know, I hope someday, you know, they'll do the right thing and help.
Interesting.
And you know the problems with our own soldiers have had with Agent Orange.
Right.
And they basically had incidental contact with the chemical.
And we're still trying to get them help.
Right. And they got that from incidental contact. We basically covered whole counties with this chemical to completely defoliate. And they have multi-generational problems. So.
Sure.
That was the only reference. You know, I just was kind of like a wistful, well, someday I hope they'll do the right thing. So I kind of cringed.
Well, they know you're a big deal, that you'll go back and you'll talk to the peeps, yeah.
But, the tunnels.
Okay,
the tunnels
quickly on the tunnels.
Okay, well, Chu Chi tunnels, you know, 58,000 Americans died in the war. 22,000 were around these tunnels. This is outside of Saigon by about 60, 70 kilometers. These tunnels started out, we were bombing the heck out of that area. And the farmers that were there dug basically bomb shelters underneath their huts.
Mm-hmm.
And after a while, they just dug deeper and they started connecting them. And that basically became the tunnel system. They were incredibly tiny. They built out, I went into the replicas, which are 2.5 times the size of the originals.
Mm-hmm.
And let me tell you, that was claustrophobic. The originals, when you went in the tunnel, I mean, it was just barely enough room to crawl on your stomach.
Really? Yeah. That's all. Okay.
And I mean, we're talking tiny. And I felt claustrophobic in the other one. So it was.
All right. Let's do this. Let's take a quick break. Let's get to some of the war chronology that might have been on and maybe off next.
The Think Tank. KTAR News on 92.3 FM and KTAR.com.
Still a little upset that I didn't get a T-shirt from Doc's Vietnam trip, but glad to have you back. And we're talking about you were talking about chronology. You're talking about the war itself. What did you see?
I want to see. Basically, we tend to think that the war only related to when the Americans were there. And basically, we had this period where we supported this French, and then we had 20 years where we were fighting ourselves.
Sure.
Well, if you want to understand what's going on, you got to
fighting on our own.
You got to understand the history. Basically, this was an independent country until about 1859. The French came in and it became a colony. And the French were in charge from then on until they got driven out. World War One. Remember why we fought World War One?
Come on. Don't give me the history lesson.
World safe for democracy.
There you go.
We're in the Versailles Treaty, and we're negotiating post-World War One. There's a Vietnamese by the name of Nguyen Al Quoc. Writes to President Wilson, goes to Versailles to argue for independence for his country. And basically he gets shut out. I guess that war was fought for democracy, but not for white people, basically.
Yeah.
By the way, Nguyen Al Quoc, the fellow I mentioned, the young guy who was out there, became subsequently known as Ho Chi Minh.
Ah, there you go.
Okay. World War II, the Japanese, for just a few months, briefly, the French, basically, after the Germans came in, the French have a little outpost there. They're, of course, devoting their attention to Europe. The Japanese are in control for a few months. 1945, the war ends. Ho Chi Minh declares the country independent. He then writes 6 letters to Harry Truman saying, can you help us? We want to be a free democratic country. He's ignored. And we start supporting the French from 1946 until 1954,
mm-hmm.
when in the famous battle at Dien Bien Phu, the French are finally have had enough, and they pull out, and then it becomes our war.
Well, it's not too hard to get the French out anywhere.
Well, just so. Anyway, that's the history. It was so, and basically, you know, 54, we start with quote-unquote advisors and gradually escalate. You know, there's a few hundred and whatever, Kennedy, and then Johnson escalates.
Do we have advisors anywhere right now? I hope we get to that in the next segment.
Well, and we will. We will, because there is a lot of analogies here, especially when I start talking about Robert McNamara.
Okay. But, all right.
Anyway, so basically— Truman shuts out. Ho Chi Minh writes to Truman, asks for help. Truman's response is to help the French. French get driven out in 1954. And for the next 20 years, 55 to 75, the U.S. is there. Interestingly, you know, and basically we're out and lose in 75. Here's the interesting thing. So for 20 years, we supposedly fight communism, right? From 75 to 85, we have a communist regime in the country.
Mm-hmm.
In 1985, they observe communism. It doesn't work.
Okay, good.
Basically, communism was ended as their economic system in 1985.
They
did a 10-year experiment. Now, like governments everywhere, the flip side of that is the Communist Party, who was in control of the government, decided that, well, we can change the economic system, but we sort of like being having us in control.
Yeah. We like the power.
So the system is nominally communist. There's nothing communist about the way the country's run, except that the party stays in control. Kind of reminded me of the Arizona legislature, actually.
Easy, you know, now. Settle down.
I think government individuals, when they get
you
in control
can't
of government.
Compare the Arizona legislature to communism.
Well, no, not to communism. I'm saying to governments that are in control, the people in control tend to think that their being in control is a good thing, and then to tend to jerry rig rules to keep themselves in control. That's the human universal.
Okay.
It's not about communism. We're the good guys.
So let's go to California. California and the Democrat run.
Absolutely.
It's the same thing.
Okay. Absolutely.
Right. Okay.
It is. Our U.S. Congress, we just happen to be sitting here in Arizona.
There you go. Yeah. Okay, got it.
People in power tend to think that the idea of their being in power is a good thing.
Absolutely,
and
it is. Sure.
And that's the human universal. But,
yes.
I mean, if you think of government as this, you know, how intrusive and big is the government, it's probably bigger here than it is there.
Mm-hmm.
For example, you buy your nice, big, fancy house in Scottsdale. And I buy one next door and I decide I want to put a pig farm in there.
Yes.
The intrusive government is going to tell me I can't do that. No such rules in Vietnam.
Good.
Anything goes.
I love that.
So
I would love a pig farm.
But
it's a little bacon.
But I want to move on. I think, and I got inspired after I got back just to go reading and digging. Robert McNamara.
Okay.
Robert McNamara, the elder among you may remember, was basically the architect of U.S. involvement in Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
He was Secretary of Defense. It was basically his strategy that ran the whole war. He was a brilliant guy. He actually got started in World War II working for Curtis LeMay, the mad bomber who subsequently was immortalized in the Dr. Strangelove.
Right,
that was,
okay.
That was Curtis LeMay.
Yeah.
And he wrote some of the most thoughtful stuff I've ever said. And he basically is very savvy, but basically our 10, 11 lessons he took away from Vietnam. And what he was really savvy about is he was never willing to take you to the conclusion, because the people have interviewed and have wanted him to say, well, would you admit you made a mistake,
mm-hmm.
you know? And he was unwilling to say yes, because he says, you know, I know if I do that, that's the headline and nobody will listen to another word I say.
That's a good point.
And so he realized he had something bigger than that. Let me read a few of these for you. And they really, I think this is where I tie it to what's going on now, because it feels like deja vu all over again, same stuff. He says, and I'm not going to read them all, but just a few of the most salient. We misjudged then, and we have since, the geopolitical intentions of our adversaries. We exaggerated the dangers to us of their actions. We viewed the people and leaders of South Vietnam in terms of our own experience. We totally misjudged the political forces within the country. In particular, we didn't get that it was nationalism. In other words, the power of people to want to be in control of their own country is like 1,000 times more powerful than words like communism or capitalism or fill in the blank.
Right.
You know? And to the old warriors who won't give up on this, I'd say think about it this way. if the Cold War ended differently and we had Russian troops marching down Central Avenue, how long before you would give up? Hmm. They interviewed, yeah. McNamara met with General Giap. General Giap lived to be about 100 years old. He was the guy who beat the French, and he was the guy who masterminded the victory against the U.S. And they asked him, and Curtis LeMay once was quoted. So he was saying, you know, what we ought to do is bomb these people into the Stone Age. And he was asked, Giap was, what you would have done. He said, it's obvious. We would have crawled into our holes, and we would have come back out in 100 years. It's our country.
Yeah.
You know, so.
You get, it's so easy, as you're saying this, to draw parallels to anything that we have going on right now,
yeah.
especially in the Middle East.
Anyway, and here another point. We failed then, and we still do, to recognize the limitations of modern high-technology military equipment.
Okay,
one of the observations about the Vietnam War, the United States military basically never lost a single battle in that war.
Okay.
They just lost the war.
Hmm.
You know, there's only so much you can do with, and I think of that. Think of the military power that we applied in Iraq.
Well, a lot of people will debate you on that, the win versus the loss. Mm-hmm. We just left. We just stopped fighting. We're done with this noise. And we won every battle, so let's just leave.
Yeah, after 30 years, we left.
Well, absolutely. Yeah. Look at Iraq, Afghanistan. Yeah.
You can always run the argument. If only we stayed another 100 years, we would have won.
Yeah, sure.
But I would
disagree with you there. I would disagree with you because no one ever drew a line and said, this is what victory looks like.
Mm-hmm.
Here's what our mission is.
Yep. Absolutely, and these are the kinds of observations that McNamara has made.
Mm.
And you know, another point: neither are people nor what he says. While we are undeniably the most powerful country on earth and will remain so for the foreseeable future, neither our people nor our leaders are omniscient. We make mistakes. Our judgment of what is in other countries' best interest should be put into open discussion in international forums. And later on, he makes the corollary point to that. And he says, therefore, if we're going to commit troops anywhere, recognizing that we don't know everything, if we can't get a truly independent international group together, and I'm not talking about countries like, right now we could get Lithuania and Poland to go anywhere, we said, because they're afraid of the Russians. They'll do whatever. But truly independent countries, the France, the Germany, the Canada, the Australia, whatever. If you can't get others on board, rethink.
Well, let's stay on that because I'm seeing a lot of interesting parallels. Apparently, a lot of us haven't learned our lessons from what we saw in Vietnam. More on that on the Think Tank.
The Think Tank, KTAR News on 92.3 FM and KTAR.com.
Hi, Mike O'Neill here, commiserating with Mike Russell. Aftermath of a fascinating 3 weeks digging into Vietnam, its history, its culture, and it's a metaphor that has sort of loomed over at least the first half of my life, and therefore, and I think probably for most people who are getting on in years, living through this. And talking specifically about Robert McNamara, who is a fascinating character, because this is not a peacenik. This is really the American architect, really, of mm-hmm. the war. And years later, he reflected on it. And he's written books on this, and there have been documentaries, and sort of the lessons from Vietnam and global lessons, I think, resonate today. This is a smart guy who's been through a whole lot, and frankly recognized, I think, the limits of his power. One of the other points that I wanted to make, and it's one that runs really tough against our culture. He says, we fail to recognize in international affairs and in other things in life, there may be problems for which there are not immediate solutions, and at times we may have to live with an imperfect, untidy world. And that's very tough against American culture. You know, American culture is, let me get in with a technology, we can fix this, right?
Mm-hmm. Sure.
And I think it's a profound thought. Sometimes there's stuff that we can't make perfect. There's things where, I mean, good Lord, look at the Middle East, for example. You know, you'd like to nudge things in a positive direction, But you've got two sides there with completely different views of the world.
I think there are some people, and we can get to this after you make your final point, but I think there are some people, and I think it's the majority of Americans, that really don't, oh man, I really hope we could nudge the Middle East into peace. Mm-hmm. No, I refuse to believe that the majority of America thinks that. I think that our ruling class thinks that, and I think it's their job. They think it's their destiny to bring peace to the Middle East.
Well, where I think you'd probably have a lot more people say yes, and where I think it's unrealistic to say, if only we applied massive military force, we could vaporize terrorism.
It's hard to vaporize an ideology.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that's what a lot of his points are, is, look, our military is an impressive machine, okay? There's no doubt it can win any military conflict anywhere. But I think the problem of Vietnam and some of our other conflicts is they're not inherently military, and therefore having the most massive military in the world isn't going to get you there. It's sort of like, you know, you got a tractor and you want to drive the Indy 500. It's a vehicle, but it's not the vehicle. You know, the problems are bigger than that. Mm-hmm. And it's like, while the execution of war may be left to military, the broader strategy about whether you do it or not is way above their pay grade. And frankly, it gets to issues of culture and some really big thoughts about, you know, is that really going to help? I mean, we can win a military. You know, we did not lose a single battle in the entire Vietnam War, but the war came out differently.
Well, yeah,
because it wasn't fundamentally a military issue.
It came out differently because there wasn't a signing on the deck of an aircraft carrier. That's why some people say it came out differently. Some people say we went in there, won every battle, and walked out of the place because this was just not really a fight worth keep fighting because we're dominating and it's over. Some say that we didn't have a clear directive and we hightailed out of there. Yeah. Win or lose, I think, is where it's the sticking point.
I think we conceptualized it. The big thing was we had this notion of that this is this domino theory, that there's this unilateral force called communism and it's trying to take over the world. Mm-hmm. I mean, an illustration of a quote from Ho Chi Minh that I will have to clean up for the radio.
Thank you.
But it says it all. He said, and he's talking back in the French, he said, I would rather smell French, poop for 5 years than have to eat Chinese poop for the next 1,000.
There you go.
We thought, the Chinese are in on this. And basically, they're searching for help. They went to us first. We said, no. This is 1945. They go to the Russians. Russians gave them some help.
Sure.
Communists took over in 49, so a year or so after that, they started to offer help too. But the Vietnamese had 1,000 years of enmity against the Chinese. They're fighting, a war to throw out a colonist. They're going to take help wherever they're going to get it, and if it's communist, they're going to take it.
Sure.
But they massively, what we thought is, they and the Chinese are unilateral, you know, they're all one thing. There's 1,000 years of history that says no way, sure. No way. They may take a little bit of help here and there right now, but this is not.
And
a
that
monolithic.
Was to McNamara's point. That was to the misjudgment. That was to the underestimation.
We viewed it through a lens. We diagnosed the problem wrong, and therefore, a incredibly massive military operation wasn't going to win because it fundamentally wasn't winnable by any. You know, it could be contained. I draw a direct line between that and Iraq. We can knock out this anytime anything coalesces big enough to be an army, we can beat it. But if everybody goes home and privately are, you know, supportive of jihadists, then they'll do IEDs or they'll just hang around until we're tired of it.
They've been fighting these battles a lot longer than we've been around. Yeah. Relatively, the United States is still the new kid on the block.
Especially historically, the Middle East.
We are the new guys.
We're not going to make everybody in the Middle East like or even get along with one another.
Yeah, winning hearts and minds, I'm not too concerned about that.
To say we can't do anything. I think there's, from time to time, there are forces there that are worse than others, and you can aid a little bit here and there to tweak it. But
sure.
But here's the thing that's the guaranteed loser, I'm sure. The day it becomes our fight, we're guaranteed to lose, because then they'll coalesce against an outside entity.
I don't think we're guaranteed to lose. The United States is the most fortified military in the world. I don't think there's anyone that can beat us.
Well,
what are you talking about?
In a battle.
Right.
In a battle, yes.
Okay.
But essentially, if you got an American army and it looks like you're trying to take over a country, then the indigenous people are going to say, wait a minute, this is our country.
Sure.
If it's a real country, which Iraq never was. You had the Shiites, you had the Sunnis, you have the Kurds. There's three countries there,
right,
really.
Or tribal lands.
And, we've tried to patch that together. And a guy like Saddam Hussein, a strong man, can do it for a while.
Mm-hmm.
Like Yugoslavia was Tito. I mean, basically, but these are entities that basically hate one another, and sooner or later, when there's not a strong man, they're going to get ripped apart.
Mm-hmm. Right, but that's what I'm saying. What I'm saying is you would have to, in anything, we talk about indigenous people, you would have to define what victory is.
Yeah.
And that's where we have a sticking point in all of the conflicts that we are currently in right now. Whether you say that we pulled troops out of Iraq, we pulled troops out of Afghanistan, we are still involved in Iraq and Afghanistan, period. When you said advisors, you mentioned that a little bit earlier.
Well, that was the words they used.
Where do we have advisors? I'm throwing my hands in air quotes here.
Well, and I see that. And the other place I always cringe is when we need to, quote unquote, train these troops. And I said, wait a minute.
Yeah.
The issue isn't training, it's loyalty. If you got guys that are throwing down their guns and going on the other side at the first opportunity, it's not how straight they can shoot. It's where are their loyalties?
Well, it's the first opportunity, and in some cases that we're seeing recently is the first sign of danger.
Yeah.
Drop the guns. I see the ISIS
flag. Well, those are mercenaries who got a job because they're paid, but they're not really committed to the mission.
Yeah.
And I think the parallels there are just undeniable.
So basically, it's a thing. You always do what you always done. You'll always get what you always got. And we're always getting what we always got, because we're continuing to do, since Vietnam, still doing the same thing.
Well, and the other thing that's going on in the current dynamic is ISIS is pulling our chain. I mean, they're SOBs. They are awful people.
Yeah.
And they did stuff that's gruesome, and it gets your blood boiling. But they want us to react. And we're doing exactly what they want.
And that's exactly. And we should not.
And it's not because they're nice guys. Not because I have an infinitesimal drop of blood of sympathy for those people.
No.
But you got to think, wait, calm down. Say, what? How do you deal with this? If we make it us,
we're
the outside guys.
Yeah, we have people in prison right now that have killed more people than ISIS has beheaded.
Yeah.
So we have to admit at some point that there are bad, like McNamara, there are bad people in the world. We have to admit there will always be bad people and stuff we can't fix.
And the Middle East is not Western Europe.
Good to have you back. Thanks for sharing your insight on Vietnam. Hey, thanks for spending some time with us right here in the Think Tank, ATAR News.